What's up, guys? Welcome to the Behind the Deal podcast, where we explore growth through acquisition. Whether you're a private equity fund manager looking to expand your portfolio or a business owner aiming to scale and build lasting value through acquisition, each of our episodes will break down the strategies, stories, the lessons that make acquisition one of the most powerful paths to growth. I hope you enjoy. On today's episode of Behind the Deal, we have Neil Doshi. Neil is a seasoned independent sponsor and M&A advisor, brings about 15 years of experience in operations, strategy, buying businesses, business development to the table across, you know, healthcare, IT, manufacturing, staffing, even commercial real estate. And now, you know, as he mentions in the show, he's buying, kind of more family-owned traditional businesses that, you know, are going to avoid AI disruption. So I think Neil brings a lot of valuable insights to the table here, especially about the independent sponsor model, especially about the 100-day plan after acquiring a company and how important that is, you know, not only as an operator, but as a fiduciary, you know, who's going to be responsible for returning capital that they raise for this opportunity. You know, you need to make sure that that team is bought in that you're buying. So without further ado, take a listen and enjoy Neil Doshi. What's going on, guys? Welcome to the Behind the Deal podcast. I'm your host, Joe Zanka, managing partner of Deal Gem Partners, and I'm here today with my guest, Neil Doshi. Neil, what's going on?
How much, Joe? Great to be on the show. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Thanks for taking the time. I'm looking forward to getting into the episode here. But before we do, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, what you're working on today and, you know, where your focus lies during the hours of the work week.
Sure. No, happy to. So I'm a managing partner firm called Forge Capital. We're headquartered in Michigan. I have an operating partner who's also resides in Michigan, and we're independent sponsors. So we focus on a deal by deal basis. And really our thesis is what I called around family founder owned businesses and the essential services. So, you know, think of anything in facilities, think of some food and beverage, but anything that we believe that artificial intelligence can't take over, but only enhance.
Sure. Awesome. Awesome. I love that thesis. I think it makes a lot of sense, you know, and AI is definitely going to be disruptive and continue to get more disruptive. But at the same time, there are certain industries that just need humans. There are certain industries that, you know, aren't going anywhere. And that's a good place to pay attention to. So you brought up a word, you know, this is an M&A podcast. I want it to be educational, but I also want it to be, you know, something that we can dive a little bit into certain topics on. So you brought up the word independent sponsor. You know, just for our audience, tell us a little bit about the difference between what an independent sponsor is and maybe what a traditional private equity fund is. And then, you know, from your perspective, what are the challenges, but also the opportunities in being an independent sponsor versus maybe a funded fund?
Sure. Great question. So a typical private equity fund already has capital allocated through limited partners. It could be institutions, pension funds, high net worth individuals, a variety of kind of asset classes. And they're, you know, a certain amount allocated in their fund. Fund one may be $200 million. It could be $500 million, whatever. And they're basing all their investments off of that fund. As independent sponsors, we don't have that committed capital fund. So we are, our LPs vary on a deal-by-deal basis. Some independent sponsors kind of have family office relationships. Other have high net worth. Some go the institutional route. But it's, again, the same premise. It's a deal-by-deal basis for their LPs.
Got it. Awesome. So in today's market, right, with the way that, you know, it's been honestly a couple of years at this point where, you know, interest rates have been high. I've seen capital get kind of tight, you know, and having conversations with intermediaries like investment bankers who are running maybe, you know, auctioned processes, right? They tend to value in some ways when they're comparing different offers, you know, they're putting some more value on people who, you know, funded sponsors, right? People who already have the funds raised. And have you found that that's brought a challenge to what you guys are doing, or do you see it as more of an opportunity, you know, in the sense that each capital, you know, each deal is its own capital stack and each deal can be kind of funded a little bit differently versus, you know, kind of being set in stone with a fund?
No, great question. So I think, you know, 5-10 years ago, the stigma around independent sponsor was a group that would sign up a slew of deals and couldn't get them funded or retrade the deals. I think that that's evolved. I think there's been, you know, plenty of data points on the success of independent sponsors. So as we go through an auction process, you know, and we don't really participate in a broad auction, but just talking to other independent sponsors that do, you know, I think credibility works with bankers, especially sophisticated bankers that understand the model. And, you know, if it's an independent sponsor group that closed several deals, it's no different than a first or second time fund out there, right? You know, especially when you're talking about lower mid market. So I don't see that stigma, you know, as prevalent as it was 5-10 years ago. I think when we go into a deal today and it's a small auction, it's not really a broad auction. It's not a big banker we don't participate in. We have kind of the track record to show, look, these are the deals and these are groups that have backed us and these are groups that have supported us on different deals that we didn't close for whatever reason. But it, I think that credibility has been there now for, you know, the better part of 5+ years that we haven't had that issue. You know, we also can structure the LOIs and things like that, but we really haven't had, you know, I can say over the last 12 months, a banker come to me and say, you know, you're an independent sponsor. I don't think you can fund it. A lot of times they'll come to me and want to know who our funding sources are, which is a legitimate question, but it's not about our credibility anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think you hit the nail on the head. Credibility goes a long way. And, you know, one thing that also goes a long way is, you know, not only a track record of closing deals, but, you know, when people ask you for that, you know, like proof, right? Not being able to, not shying away from it, right? Just being like, yeah, here's our capital sponsors. Here's the people who have committed to us. Here's the relationship that we have with them. Here's maybe some deals that we've closed with them before. Like if we like something, you know, we can get it done at the number that we presented to you and here's how, right? And I think that there are other sponsors 100%. Out there who, you know, are maybe they're just getting started. Maybe they lack the experience and maybe, you know, it's going to take them a while to get there. But, you know, they're putting in offers and then kind of crossing their fingers that they're going to be able to put the capital together. And, you know, there's obviously some challenges with, you know, just the, even the existing market right now. Money's not as cheap as it maybe it was, you know, at certain other times. And it just seems like a risky play. You know, it's one thing, it's nice to tie up a deal. It's nice to get a deal, you know, under your belt. And that's an important piece of, you know, growing any sort of portfolio. But at the same time, you know, that reputational risk can be detrimental if it goes the wrong way.
No, you're spot on. I think it used to be, you know, I think brokers and bankers would think that independent sponsors just want to sign up deals. And then, you know, try to figure out how to fund them. And I tell anyone that when we look at a deal, it's more work and more cost for us to sign up a deal, especially if we're not 100% committed that we want to close this deal, we want to fund this deal, we want to work to fund this deal, I should say. I think, you know, at the end of the day, just like anything, right? Your first job out of college is the best example. You interview for a job and you're hearing, well, you need experience. Well, how do you get experience if you just graduated from college? It's kind of the chicken and the egg kind of thing. And, and being an independent sponsor is really no different, right? I remember hearing, you know, several years ago, well, have you closed the deal? No. Well, call me when you close the deal. Well, I can't call you until I close the deal, right? Like I have a great deal on the table. So I think, and that was, you know, 8 years ago when I started. I think today from talking to new independent sponsors, I think because the ecosystem's broadened, I think now we're starting to see, regardless of the capital markets, right? I think you just price it in accordingly, right? Like if you think of real estate, you know, a 2% 30-year mortgage, you can sell your house for 5-7% more. Now with, you know, your mortgage rate triple that, you can't. I think it's no different in a lower mid-market deal. Your deal is priced based on a few conditions, right? Market, cost of capital to be a couple, the quality of the deal, obviously, the team and slew factors, but this is just another variable. But overall, I think where the ecosystem's gone for an independent sponsors, if they structure a deal properly and, you know, if they give it, you know, if they have a strong thesis, deals will get done.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I'm seeing them, you know, I've seen both sides of the equation with what we do, right? We source deals for, you know, independent sponsors, we source deals for private equity funds, we source deals for family offices. I've seen both sides of the coin where, you know, when I bring a deal to certain independent sponsors who, you know, we're working with, I have no doubt that, you know, if they're able to get under LOI and if that seller is fully committed to selling their company, that they're going to be able to close. And then there are other people who, you know, in some way, shape or form, there still feels like a little bit of a coin flip sometimes. But sure. You know, it all comes down to, like you said, your experience, your relationship to your funds, and that, you know, that track record, right? And that, you know, expertise in knowing, you know, hey, this is the number we're going to put forward. This is why we can back it up, not only with a spreadsheet, but we know that we can get it funded at that number, right? And if we try to go too high and the spreadsheet starts to break and the partners start to, you know, look into it a little bit more, I mean, this isn't going to work out the way it does. So I see a lot of the time people putting forward deals and they're really not, you know, putting forward LOIs, and, you know, a lot of the pros don't really leave a lot of wiggle room in those. Like, there's some things that can be negotiated, but at the same time, they're like, we came up with this number for a reason because we know we can get the deal done at that number, and we know it makes sense at that number, you know, and we're not just throwing in a number, hopefully, you know, lowballing somebody, hoping they accept it. Like, this is what we can do from experience, not from hope, you know.
No, you're 100% right. Like, you, anybody can win a deal, right? You can, you know, take a 6x deal and bid 10x and win the deal, but you can't fund the deal, right? Even if you're a traditional private equity fund, because investment committee is going to look at you, you know, and say, why would you bring this deal? It's not worth that. And that's no different, right? If you're shopping for a house, you know, and the house is in a $500,000 neighborhood, you bid $1 million, no bank's going to appraise it. So I think your point's valid. When we look at deals, we're probably a little unique. We're not as stressed about the financial return because of leverage, right? So we're not going to take a deal and over lever the deal. You know, in our experience as operators, my partner's got 25 plus years. I got 15 plus years. We're looking at it knowing that every business has ups and downs. It, as great as a business is, it's not run on a spreadsheet. So we always want to have a buffer in where our lender is not coming to us in year one, year two, going, by the way, you're in default to your loan, so to speak. So I think, you know, independent sponsors need to be cognizant of that, not look at it and say, let me put, you know, five turns of leverage on a deal. And then all of a sudden, you know, they realize, shoot, I need to bring in a CFO, or I need to, or we have a soft quarter because of whatever. I'm in trouble. You can't, you got to realize every business is going to have some pitfall you can't assume.
Absolutely. So switching gears a little bit here, you know, you're someone who, because of your expertise and because you've been doing this for, you know, quite a better part of your career, I'm sure you see a lot of deals, right? You know, thousands, maybe a year of opportunities, but you know, you're not buying, you know, dozens and dozens, hundreds of deals, right? You're buying maybe a couple companies a year. So what key criteria is, you know, when you see a teaser or you, you know, talk to a founder, help you kind of quickly identify and prioritize those high potential opportunities versus just every other opportunity that comes across the desk?
Yeah, we see a high volume in deals for compared to most shops, but to your point, you're right, Joe. We're not bidding and we're not trying to close 6, 7, 8 platforms here. Our goal is typically 2 platforms, and, you know, add-ons are opportunistic in nature. And, you know, it breaks down. The first thing we look at is this a family founder-owned business? Okay. Is this within our EBITDA thresholds, right? You know, typically we look deals typically 2.5 and up of EBITDA. It's a little south of that. We'll look at it depending on geography. Okay. If it's up there, that's great. Is it a business service that we understand and comfortable and are bullish on? If it hits that, okay. Now we hit 3. Okay, great. We probably would sign off on the NDA. And you get to the SIM or the booklet, and then we would look at, you know, other basic things is how are the numbers been driven over the last 3, 4, 5 years, right? Is it hockey stick growth? Has it been, you know, fluctuating? Is it down? Where is it? And then what's the customer concentration like? You know, so those are, you know, we do have like a 6-point checklist we look at for each deal, but those are really at a high level what we're looking at, what we're scrubbing for initially. And, you know, we're not going to be a group that's going to take a high risk. I tell people we're probably a value type buyer, and I'm okay with that because I can get comfortable knowing, you know, if the deal has a struggle for the first year for whatever reason, maybe it's a J curve because we've brought on a CFO, we've increased the operating load of the business, but we know that in years 2, 3, 4, and 5, this business is ready and primed for growth.
Absolutely. No, it's great to have those like checkpoints that you can go, you can see something and you can say right off the top of your head, like, hey, this is worth spending the time, energy, effort, money, you know, to research. And this may not be right. Just getting some feedback.
Right. Because, right. Like, you know, whether you're a, you know, committed funder or an independent sponsor, you don't have time to waste on looking at every deal if you already know you're not going to get it screened? It just doesn't make any sense. And we're no different.
For sure. So, you know, talk to me about, I mean, you got to a point in your career where now you feel you understand how to look at a deal. You understand that you can get it capitalized. You understand, you know, the dynamics of being this independent sponsor. But, you know, take me back to prior to kind of going down this road yourself and starting your own journey. What was getting that first deal done like? You know, maybe tell me a little bit of a story about what was that first deal where maybe you stepped out of the corporate world and closed one on your own, and maybe even go as far as giving me a story around what was challenging about that first one.
Yeah, great question. So I gave myself, and I told my wife this, 2 years to close my first deal. And if I couldn't, I'd go back to corporate America and go find a job and whatever it might be, probably something in operations. But I needed to, it was something I was bullish on. You know, I'd spent a lot of time researching independent sponsor world, private equity. That I always knew that if I didn't do it, I would regret it. So I said, 2 years, if I can't close the deal, okay, it's just not for me. I didn't have this talent, whatever. It just wasn't going to happen in the cards. And really, I think it was at the 19-month mark or the 20-month mark where I closed my first deal. I can tell you the last 3-4 months, I was sweating. You know, I had a couple other deals under letter. We had one deal, I remember, where we had everything lined up and quality of earnings came back extremely light, and we walked away. We had a deal that didn't close at like the 2-yard line for a tax reason, all in the first 18 months. And I remember thinking, man, I'm never going to get a deal done, it felt like. But, you know, that first deal, I was sweating bullets, no debate, because I knew I had, you know, a 2-year time frame. And, you know, once that first one crossed the finish line, it was, you know, it's like a load that just off your shoulders. It's, you know, right. It's like a piano came off my back, whatever you want to use. And it just gave me confidence, because I think you need to prove to yourself, as much as you want to say you can do it, that you can do it. Once that first deal came in, you know, I started to realize, okay, the model that I believe in, it can work. And then you just, you know, it's like anything else. You get more experience, you get better at it, right? You get better at screening deals, you get better at valuing deals, you get better at modeling, all of it. You get better at learning and what questions to see, what pitfalls. But that's just like anything else in the corporate world or any other job. Is it just takes a little bit on that front end to learn and understand.
100%. I mean, good for you for giving yourself 2 full years to get a deal closed, because I think a lot of people go into some of these things, whether it's an entrepreneurial adventure or whether it's, you know, an independent sponsor type angle where you're trying to close and buy a company with just too short of a timeline. And, you know, you need, you need more time than you think. I think you need double as much time as you think all the time. You know, I think you need to, like, if you want something to happen quickly, or, you know, until someone proves otherwise, if someone tells you a deadline, like most of the time, let's just double it in your head and put that down on the calendar. Yeah. And if that's okay, then we'll stick with it. But, you know, if that's not going to be okay, you got to address it. But long story short, I mean, good for you for giving yourself 2 years, because I think, you know, even with me starting deal gen, right, it didn't take too long to close that many deals, but it took a long time for us to realize what we should be doing. It took us a long time to, and honestly, I don't know if I would have gone as far as I did. If at the beginning I told myself, like, you know, hey, this is like, if I knew how hard it was going to be, I don't know if I would have stuck with it. No one will. Honestly.
Yeah. Spot on. You know, you're right. You know, you hit the nail on the head though. You have to learn through your mistakes. Right. And to your point, if you give yourself a 6-month time frame, you don't have enough time to learn. Right. Like, I mean, just think this, even if the first deal you saw as an independent sponsor, or I saw as an independent sponsor, I was able to close, that itself is typically a 6 to 8 month time frame. That's 6 to 8 months. If I'm not giving myself 2 years, I'm literally saying I got to close on the first or second deal. And the same thing with any business you run, you got to learn. Like, you're going to make, God knows, the millions of mistakes. I look back and some of them, I'm like, God, I how stupid could I have been? But, you know, that's, you know, 7-8 years ago now, right? Now you look at it and I'm like, okay, I know exactly, not exactly, but, you know, I have really good, within a 90% kind of certainty of what I need to look at with the deal now. And I know, you know, from conversations, I know from looking at numbers, okay, this is what this deal should be trading for. And if it's not within, let's call it this range, a short, small range too. We're not talking like a 2-multiple range. We're talking, you know, 1/2 to 3/4 of a multiple range. If it's not trading in there, I'm not going to be the guy to win the deal. But I would have never known that 7 years ago when I started this. It's impossible. You just don't have enough data. You don't have enough knowledge. And in as many books as I read on learning private equity and people I talk to, it's like anything else. You just got to get your feet wet.
1000%. And you got to stick with it, and you got to be able to stick with it,
100%.
You know, because that's, once you quit, it's over. Right. But if you stick with 100%. It and you can give yourself the opportunity to get over that hump. And like you said, close that first deal, get the weight off your back, and then go and operate, you know, you'll just, that's what you need to do to learn. You know, it's funny. I listen to a lot of, most of the podcasts I listen to for whatever reason are like around comedians and stand-up comedy and actors and stuff. I do listen to quite a few business ones too, but it's funny. A lot of those guys say like, it takes 10 years to get good at stand-up comedy. Like, and by good, they mean like you're selling out shows on the road, 10 years, you know? And like, they tell all the younger comics like, hey, this is a 10-year thing, man. And after the 10 years, you'll start reaping the rewards. And I think sometimes about business and I'm like, shame on me for thinking that like, I should be so much further along in like your third or fourth year doing something, right? It's like, I'm doing well. Oh, yeah. You got to pat yourself on the back sometimes and be like, hey, you've made it this far. Things are going pretty well. You know, you can see in front of you, like the pathway to get to where you want to be. You just got to stay on that road. You can't just always be like, oh, well, why didn't I know that? Or why am I still here? Right. It's like, the journey is a piece of it. You just can't stop doing it. Once you stop, then that's kind of when you stop learning too.
No, you're right. It's funny is I think I heard Jerry Seinfeld said it took him about 15 years before he realized his return on investment. So you're with comedians, but too often we look at things and we think it happened overnight, right? Everyone today looks at Amazon and says, wow, this business was created, and the next day everybody was doing, next day shipping or something. Amazon started as a bookstore, right? It started as an online bookstore. He pivoted, he learned. If he quit in 1 year, there would be no Amazon, right? I mean, I think it was 17 years or something like that till they went public. So that's 17 years. That's a lifespan, right?
Yeah. If
you quit, if you're quitting in 6 months, you're not doing anything as you grow up. That's just the way I look at it. I don't know how you succeed in something in 6 months. There's nothing outside of winning the lottery that you can do in 6 months.
Completely agree. So you talk to me about, speaking of timelines, right? So you get that deal closed, whether it's the first one or whether it's one that you've closed recently. How do you approach that first 100 days post-close to ensure that, you're in alignment with the new business? You try to mitigate surprises, right? Try to make sure that you're not, nothing's coming up like that's drastic that you didn't know about already.
Yeah.
And then, how do you kind of maybe build some credibility with that existing team within those first 100 days? Because you've already convinced the seller that you're the right partner, but now you got to convince the rest of the team, and some of them have been there for 30 years maybe. And they don't like change, they don't want to change. So talk to me about that process.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that we've learned and evolved from. We would, when I first started, we would look at a 100-day plan post-close. We'd close the deal, and then we'd, have the kickoff meeting, and we'd work on a 100-day plan. And I realized that's too late. There's just too much time being done where there's no change, there's no status. These are founder, family-owned businesses, and I tell them they're great businesses because, some guy's built it out of his garage or his apartment, and built a phenomenal business, but 9 times out of 10, there's no real processes. And all we're doing we have 5 years of a holding period. If I spent the first 4 months doing nothing because I didn't have a 100-day plan, I've lost, take it 1/20th or something like that of my total time frame to get to that return. That's a lot of time. What we've evolved to do is really probably, 15 to 20 days before we're closing a deal, and it varies obviously on when we can set up meetings, is we have a 100-day plan and we have our outline of it. That doesn't mean that's what it's gonna happen, but then we talk to the team, right? We'll talk to that executive team and say, these are how we envision the first 100 days. Walk us through your thoughts. What do you think that we're missing? What do you think that makes no sense? What do you agree and disagree with? And we take that, our internal document, we turn into a collaborative workforce. And then by closing, we have an idea of what that first 100 days looks like. And all of a sudden we're off and running from day one. And we haven't wasted 120 days like we used to.
Wow. Okay. That's awesome. No, I mean, that's getting ahead of the curve, even if, again, like while you're going through some of these acquisitions, obviously some of the information is maybe kept private from the rest of the company, just in case certain things don't happen, you know, people don't start quitting, right? Like, and that is a big piece of like that, you know, not making sure the cat gets out of the bag too early. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you can't put in place what you think the right plan should be and agree at least with, you know, if you have an owner who might be rolling equity or transitioning, you know, if they agree on the plan, then now you're going into it not only with, you know, some sort of concrete initiative, but you're going on, you know, into it with the existing head of their organization bought into it as well, and being able to like help make that transition, and you know, so building that relationship with the owner is just, it sounds like it's honestly just as important whether they're sticking around and rolling equity or they're just going to help you transition out of this thing, you know, having them understand the plan and what it's going to look like to move forward. And I see a lot of the time, especially in the types of business that you guys are looking for, the owners aren't always like, the amount of money that they're taking home isn't actually always their biggest concern. It's what's going to happen to the legacy I built and what's going to happen to the people that helped me build it, you know?
Right.
And that is that a big part of how you guys address some of these things too?
90%+ of the time, you hit the nail on the head there. Most founders have made, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 million of free cash flow a year for the last decade or so, right? So, you know, my valuation of cash at close, let's say from 20 million to 23 million, it's not moving the needle to that guy. You know, he or she's looking at it going, $3 million is great. It's just estate money at this point. You know, my cost, my quality of life isn't getting better or worse because of that $3 million. It's really, what is my brand name as a company look like post-close, right? Like, we're looking at a deal which is, you know, it's a 40-plus-year-old business. It's in a rural town, and the guy's focus is, what does my team look like once you guys take over, right? He doesn't, you know, our cash at close number, it was market. I'm not saying it's below market, but at the same time, you know, he didn't spend a lot of time kind of questioning that or arguing about that or negotiating that. You know, he looked at it and said, okay, we're talking to my, you know, broker, banker. I think we're fair. It's a fair market deal. Maybe I could have got a half a million more, but I want to know what happens to my chief estimator I've had for 20 plus years, my COO, my general manager. That's more important to him. And I think it goes back to what you just said. How do you get buy-in, right? How do you get all of these guys and or women to be like, okay, this group has our best interest at heart. This group is looking at growing this business, right? Because private equity also has a negative stigma. Some of it deserves, some of it stereotyped, whatever you want to call it. So how do you, you know, change that narrative? And I think that 100-day plan where you go in and you say, these are our thoughts, but this isn't, you know, in stone, right? Because yes, I've operated businesses. Yes, my partners operate businesses. But every business is different. And, you know, my 15 hours, 20 hours in a business is nothing compared to, you know, the COO's 20 years in the business. So let's take their feedback. You know, we're partnering with them. We're not firing anybody. We tell them that, right? We're growth focused. So if you're a 30-person shop today, our goal is, how do we get to 40, 50, 60 people? You know, not how do you go from 30 and downsize to 15? So that means we need all of those people, you know, from the janitor to the CEO. So it has to be collaborative. It has to be buy-in. Because if I can get the executive team to buy in and be excited, then I know that they have the culture and team in place to get everyone underneath them excited. And all of a sudden, the success of our plan goes up 5, 6, 10-fold, something around that number.
That's awesome. No, I love the way that you guys approach it. And honestly, I mean, sometimes they get the... stereotypes are the way they are sometimes for a reason. And you know, there are other firms that have taken the approach of, well, I'm just going to buy this company and strip unnecessary costs, you know? And I think obviously you can look at a balance sheet and see, you know, there's, or, you know, P&L and see some unnecessary costs. But when you look at just like people or divisions or anything like that, is like, all right, as soon as we buy this thing, you know, we're going to free up a $500,000 or $1 million by just firing these people. That, you know, I guess that's an approach that, some people have built, you know, strong firms on, but at the same time, it's also what's gotten us here where you said, like, there's a lot of fear around private equity. When people hear that word sometimes, especially, you know, founders, there's fear. And then, but you know, founders a lot of the time have maybe interacted with or had calls with acquirers in their past, right? Their team is probably usually head down doing what they do for their, for a living. And they might not, you know, they might just hear what they, you know, hear in movies or, you know, hear from friends. Right. And when for they hear that we're private equity, it strikes fear, right? Like I might lose my job. Like that's probably what they're honestly thinking sometimes.
First thing.
So by getting ahead of it and addressing it up front and be like, no, we need you guys. You guys are super important to the success of this organization, and getting that buy-in. Sure. There's going to be people after you acquire it, you know, 6 months of a year down the road who, you know, may not still be operating the same way they once were. And that needs to be addressed, right. But you know, you get the buy-in from the team at the beginning. It just sets the stage for success moving forward.
You're spot on, right? Like it's first impressions, right? This is a marriage, right? I tell everyone this, when you acquire, especially a lower mid-market business, it's a typical 5 year to six, you know, 5 year hold. You look to bring it to market. So by year six, you've sold off, you know, that corporation now. That's a, that's a marriage. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. So if your first date is bad, the rate of divorce in this case is really high, which means that, you know, if you're looking for a 3x or greater return, you can throw it out the window because you don't have anybody on your side that believes in you at that office. And, you know, unless you plan on, you know, really gutting the institution and bringing on all of your people and hoping that whole execution is pretty much flawless, which the odds are probably less than 5%. It's a failed asset at that time.
Yep. No. And that's just a totally, you know, a different way of looking at like the overall approach, right? When you say like, hey, at the end of the day, you're taking other people's capital and you're putting it to work. And so you need to be a fiduciary. And part of that fiduciary responsibility isn't just looking at numbers. It's looking at the people that are going to make sure that you get that, you ultimately do get that return that you promised to those investors, and you do, you know, carry out your duty. Right. So much goes into it, you know, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I'm sure you learned, you know, a lot of this, just doing it right. And really kind of getting in the weeds, understanding like, hey, you know, making one acquisition, going through the full cycle, and then making another one and being like, you know what, this is what we got to do better next time. This is what we got to do better next time. And all those little improvements along the way, whether you're growing a business, starting a business, you know, buying businesses like you are, it just compounds and compounds and compounds. And, you know, so not only the returns are compounding, but just the amount of experience and tweaks and improvements that you make, you know, just continue to add more and more leverage, which, you know, it ultimately turns into leverage and why, you know, you might be able to raise more money and buy bigger businesses and get bigger returns, you know, but the theme is you got to stick with it and, you know, and be willing to fail, be willing to make mistakes, because no one's ever done anything, especially anything valuable, without doing either of those things.
No, you're right. Well, you know, you talked about the amount of deals that people see and close, right? You're closing less than 1% of the deals you see every year. The vast majority of firms, you're probably closing less than a 0.5%. And, you know, along the same lines, you know, for every three LOIs, you're closing one deal typically. It's a 40% kind of close rate. So you're failing most of the time. And you have to understand that. You have to appreciate that. You have to, you know, to steal a Ted Lasso line, you have to be a goldfish. And you just gotta like look and learn and say, it's off to the next one and not take it personally. And, you know, it's okay to be down for a little bit because it's probably the competitor in you, but it's not okay to wallow because you're going to fail that way. And that's just, you know, that's how I've always looked at it. And I've made more mistakes than probably 90% of the independent sponsors out there. And I'm okay with it because at least I figured I'm going to learn the most because I'm making the most mistakes.
Yeah. Really good point. And look, with that, you know, we can kind of call it a wrap here, but Neil, I really appreciate you, man. Thank you so much for coming on, sharing your insights. This is super valuable. You know, I think a part of our audience, a good chunk of it actually, is going to come from, you know, LinkedIn and maybe a database and a newsletter that we send out to our existing pipe drive. A lot of those people are intermediaries who have deals. You know, if they listen to this and look up your firm, look up your profile, and they want to, you know, maybe send you an opportunity, where's the best place to find you?
Yeah, let's start with my email. It's Neil, NEAL, @forged.com. And Joel, thank you for having me. Thanks for the opportunity. Really had a great time.
Yeah, me too, man. Awesome. This has been great. I appreciate it. Neil, we'll have a good weekend. We'll take care.
Sounds great. You as well.
All right, thanks, man. Joel. Thanks. Take care. Nice, man. That was great.
Thank you, Joel. Appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity. I truly appreciate it. Had fun.
That's awesome. No, I think that was great. I think we can, you know, that long form episode is going to be awesome. I think we'll be able to cut that up into some pretty good clips. So usually these things take, my editor might take like a week to kind of chop it all up and get it going. But once it's cut up and once we have, you know, some examples of the episode, I'll make sure to share it with you. And then when I, please, you know, post it anywhere, I'll tag a bio, I'll tag the email, tag the LinkedIn. I'll, you know, make sure I'm tagging you on anything like that. And yeah, we can just use it as a way to share content, honestly. And my hope and dream, like I said, maybe on our first conversation was, you know, maybe you can use this as a tool, right? As you're talking to business owners and, you know, they're trying to get a feel for who you are and what you guys do. It's like, hey, you can go to our website, you can check my LinkedIn out, but listen to this, you know, this gives you a flavor of who we are and what we believe in. And
for sure,
I think that would be a cool thing to, you know, a cool little value add that I can hopefully bring to guys like yourself.
I agree, Joe. No, I appreciate it. I think it's great. I think it gives great credibility, not just to our firm, but to independent sponsors, because there's going to be that stigma or fear. And, you know, having conversations like this are great. So I appreciate it. And, you know, whenever you send it out, send me a link. I'll do the same through, you know, my LinkedIn site.
Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate you. Enjoy the weekend.
No,
you know,
likewise.
Hopefully you get to
you as well.
Relax a
Let
little bit.
Let me know
bit.
What I think I could do. Yeah, you as well, man. Enjoy yourself. I don't know where you're at, but the weather out here is gorgeous in Michigan, so I'm going to try to enjoy myself.
Yeah, I'm in Boston, and it's we got to enjoy the next month or two while we can, because it's going to start getting cold.
Agreed. So. Sounds great.
All right, Neil. I'll see you, man. Thank you.